time to catch the beat from Market Street on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Your community radio station is in the heart of the action in downtown Champaign. And Catch the Beat brings highlights of local news, arts, culture, and issues to pay attention to. As always on WEFT, the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Inc., Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. I'm your host, Cope Cumston. I'm pleased to welcome to this week's show Jane Kuntz, Urbana resident, former faculty in the U of I's Department of French, and noted translator of literary works from French to English. Developing a career after your early work following 4 years in Tunisia, teaching as part of the Peace Corps. During this time, you became, during this time, you became deeply invested in the culture and history of the Medina of Tunis, known as one of the first Arabo-Muslim towns of the Maghreb, dating from 698 AD. It's an ancient human settlement, the center of numerous dynasties with great culture and wealth in the Arab world, filled with renowned mosques, palaces, and residences. And you've been a faculty member in the Department of French at the University of Illinois, where you specialized in the cultural productions of the Francophone in Maghreb. Did you remember that, Jane? Is that how you saw it, your time at the U of I?
Well, since everyone in the French department has a specialty, that was the slot that I filled. Yeah. Yes.
Well, so anyway, French is your genre. Let's just talk about what brought you into your career as a translator, which I see as the center of our focus today, and what interests you. And I want to ask some particular things, because I think the art of translation is a really fine art that isn't appreciated, and I would love to get your take on that. So start us off. What led you in this direction?
Well, just as a slight corrective to your introduction, I was actually in Tunisia for 18 years, mm-hmm. four of which were with the Peace Corps, but the rest I was actually teaching in the university system. The University of Tunis as a lecturer. And because English was at best the third language, and I would say probably the fourth language after Arabic, French, Italian, and just starting to be English, there was a great need for even the simplest brochures for tourism and various documents. And in fact, I actually did a little work for the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which at that time was located in Tunis. But in any case, it was always a question of need that came before desire. People sought us out as native English speakers to help at very least edit things that Tunisians had done and that needed serious editing. So I guess I learned my craft by doing. It wasn't something I necessarily sought out, but I loved it. It was fun. And there was always a lot of back and forth because, as you know, no one ever agrees about what the best translation is. Are you sure that's what, you know, try this, what about this? Which is why the famous canonical books always get translated and retranslated and retranslated, because they need that kind of updating for a new readership or a corrective for what they consider a faulty translation by someone who didn't know what he or she was doing, perhaps. So that was the way I got into it. Subsequently, when I came back to the United States and started doing my PhD, I had the good fortune of meeting up with John O'Brien, who was the founder of the Dalkey Archive Press in Bloomington Normal, which then moved to the University of Illinois and was housed here for a short time. And he asked me over coffee one day, would you be interested in translating some French works into English? He had a slate of them.
Well, Dalkey is known for their translation.
Exactly.
Because I come out of publishing, I was at the U of I Press, I know that translation is difficult to fund for a publisher. It's expensive.
Right. And the way Dalkey did it, and the way perhaps many of the even more prominent publishing houses do that, is to obtain subventions, you know, subsidies from the governments of the speaker country. For instance, Switzerland, France, Belgium would offer Dalkey not a huge amount of money, but some funds to subsidize the translator. Now, the problem with Dalkey, and this is not to badmouth them, they still exist, they didn't always give all that money to the translator. They kept some for themselves, of course, because it's a nonprofit. Dalkey is a nonprofit publishing house that works almost exclusively on grants, the Lannan Grant and other such grants. So it was basically a labor of love. We were paid a pittance compared to what I would go on to earn, for instance, when I published books with university presses like Stanford University Press that paid a decent amount. You know, it was based on the number of pages, the number of words, whatever their calculation was. Dalkey was not in a position to do that. So he made that very clear. He said, "This is the most I can offer you. Are you still interested?" And since money really wasn't the purpose, I said yes. And I did one, then two, then three, and it was kind of an ongoing thing for a while until Dalkey lost its subsidies from the French government for reasons that I never understood, but there was some sort of falling out between the press and the French cultural affairs. So he was no longer able to offer anything. What's going on right now, I don't know. As we know, John O'Brien passed a few years ago, and the operation is being run by someone else, I think, under very different circumstances. So that's how I got started. And I will say quite honestly that I never, only once did I actually take a book to Dalkey and say, "I want to translate this." In all other cases, they had a book available and asked me if I was interested, and I would read it and say yes or no. And every other book after that, not with Dalkey, but with other mostly university presses, same thing. I would be contacted by a publisher who, through friendships and actually a person a very instrumental person that I met at Stanford, she would suggest my name. And that's how it happened. I never sought these books out. And after the Dalkey experience, everything I did after that was nonfiction.
Did you prefer that to fiction?
Let's say it was far less anxiety-inducing when you're dealing with, especially a living author whose English is good enough to ask you to send chapters as you're doing them, so that she, I'm thinking of someone in particular, Christine Montalbetti, who insisted, and this was part of our agreement, to see my chapters as I was doing them to make sure I was on point. And she would come back with notes, lots of notes, which I appreciated, but it was humbling, very humbling, and something obviously you can't do if the author is deceased. I found it in the end that no matter what I did, it was never going to live up to her standards because she knew in her head what she meant. Her lexical choices could either just not be matched by English or could not be matched by my English. I wasn't a, I don't think, and I'll be honest, I don't think I was a particularly skilled translator of fiction. I'm not a fiction writer. I don't even journal. I mean, I'm not a writer. So what I did probably to her ears just wasn't poetic enough in the way that her prose is very poetic and kind of dreamy. So I felt that the heat was off when I was doing a straight, like the book about the city of Jerusalem, one of the more recent ones that I did, which was just fascinating. But you know, it said what it said, and lots of footnotes and you know, references and things. So that is far less challenging.
What hooked you about the process of translating as work that you wanted to develop?
Well, as since I did a PhD in French and as an aspiring, at least, academic, it was a way of doing academic work without having to do the research. Someone else had already done all the research for me. So it was a way of honing my academic writing skills, for what that was worth, without having to do all the legwork. Someone had already done it. And I'll tell you a story. I think I mentioned this in an email to you. that would prove that sometimes the translator can find things that the original editor of the original version of the book is not in a position to find. This was an already published book by a very prestigious publishing house in France, Seuil, about a subject. I don't want to embarrass either them or the author, but as I was researching for my translation of the book, many of her sources, of course, were English, because she was translating something that had been written about a lot in English already. There was a vast corpus of work on her subject already existing in English, mostly by American writers. And rather than take her French and try to retranslate it back into English, I just went to the original to try to find it. And luckily, the University of Illinois Library had everything that I needed. All the resources were there, so I just had to go to the library, look at her bibliography, find the books, find the page, and just copy out the reference, which, of course, she quoted with the author. But as I was doing that, I discovered that there were long passages in that book that were not quotes, but were clearly translated directly from this author. She had just lifted them out of these books, kind of right next to the thing that she quoted, but she just, rather than continuing her quote, and this is a kind of slippage that happens, you know it does.
Well, we hear about it a number of
cases. We hear about it a lot. And you know, this is an elderly woman, and maybe, but in any case, her editor at Seuil was not in a position to go back to all her sources and make sure she had used quotation marks and had cited. But that's the kind of work that a translator can do, because you're digging into it. And in that particular case, I had to write to my American publisher and say, look, I don't know that we should be doing this. You know, I found all these examples. What do you think? You know, should we give her a second chance? I mean, the book already exists. It's out there in French. There's nothing you can do about it. She's not going to rewrite it with errata, you know, saying, I'm sorry, I didn't quote. A mistake had been made. And who knows if she had researchers working for her who made the mistake. I'm not pointing fingers at anybody. I just pointed it out to the publisher and said, I don't think we should go forward with this book. And he said, fine, paid me for what I'd done. And they canceled the contract.
That's something. Yeah.
Well, it was honest.
Yeah.
It was very honest, because they had already, this was probably highly embarrassing for them.
Yeah.
I haven't heard from him since. And I don't know if I had done something that made me, that raised red flags and we're not going to work with her anymore because she's digging a little too deep. But at any rate, those are the kinds of things that make, I mean, it's unfortunate, but it makes work exciting, that kind of work exciting. I learned so much by researching these nonfiction books about the authors in particular and what they're doing and who they are and what they mean in the French cultural landscape. For instance, it's not rare. I listen to a lot of French podcasts on the French national radio called France Culture, and I'll suddenly hear my author being interviewed about a book that I just translated, not talking about the translation, but talking about his book or a subsequent book. So it's exciting to feel kind of included in the conversation and to know these people personally. Two of the French authors I have translated, in fact, have come to the University of Illinois on one of those French Cultural Center junkets that they do, you know, traveling around to various cities. And it was such a delight to meet them and meet them in the flesh. And one of them actually invited me to France. He was inviting all the translators of his work for a kind of Festschrift, you know, for him. And I was invited.
Did you go?
Of course I went. It was really fun. We're still in touch. He's, I would say, of all the authors, he's the only one that I'm still in touch with. These are the kind of side benefits of translation of living authors and living academics in particular. You hear sometimes secondhand that they've appreciated your work, and because English is such an important language for academics to have their works published in. French is important, but it's nowhere near as important and getting less and less important than English. So to have one's academic work published in English means so much to their careers. You know, suddenly people in Singapore and, you know, all the English language speakers can read their work in a way that they wouldn't if it were only in the native tongue.
Is there a distinction in the publishing world between American English and British English for a translator?
Not that I know of. You know, I've never even thought about that. Of course, you know, there are lexical differences and spelling differences and all of those sorts of things. Sometimes I get the feeling that the British get the first crack at the really famous British, really? Like Welbeck or someone like that. Uh-huh. I get the feeling that the British, since they're right there, and they tend to, they're chummier with those writers. You've perhaps heard of Michel Welbeck. He's the famous bad boy writer in France right now. And I think his translators are British, if I'm not mistaken. And it hardly matters. But since I'm not really in the fiction racket, I don't know how much competition there is for the publishing houses in the United States, New Directions and other press and things like that, that tend to get the big translations, or even FSG for that matter. Are they in competition with the British publishers? These days, I feel like all the publishing houses are owned by one conglomerate anyway, but you were talking not so much about the publishing houses as the translators themselves.
Right.
My guess would be that the British get more fiction and perhaps the Americans get more nonfiction because there are more universities.
That's interesting.
And more universities in the press. That's completely off the top of my head. I have no basis for saying that, but because the university presses in the United States are so numerous, that might be, well, you worked for Stanford for many years, so you know that they were in a position to get a lot of juicy work.
Right. Walk us through some kinds of examples of the kinds of decisions you need to make as a translator on specific sentences, specific concepts that you need to render in English.
Well, one problem that I've often had with French is the past tenses. Because we have, for instance, I went, I have gone, I have been going, I had been going, I had gone. You know, we have this array of past tenses that somehow don't always get rendered in French. For example, the French have the historic past that no one uses anymore. Zero. I mean, Proust used it. And people who are writing, you know, straight history will use it, and the encyclopedia uses it or whatever. But the French, especially fiction writers these days, will tend to write a lot of things that happened in the past in the present. And it sounds like, so this guy goes into a bar and he sits down and, you know, so there, it happened in the past. You're telling a story that happened in the past, but you put it all in the present. And it sounds kind of jokey to me in English. So this guy comes up to me and he says, you could also say, this guy came up to me and he said, but there's something about putting it into the present that makes it seem more more real, and you can identify it with. A lot of French writers write their past accounts in the present, I often think, as a way to avoid all the messy past tense choices. And I don't feel like I've ever really come to grips with exactly. I'd like to talk to a grammarian. Maybe I'll talk to Doug Kibbe about that. He's our resident grammarian, and see what he thinks about this this tendency to write in the present. So that's one very, very specific problem that doesn't occur in the nonfiction books that I've done, because everything is always very straightforward. This happened, and then this happened, and in 1870, this happened. You know, you put it in the past. You're not going to try to bring that up into any of our array of present tenses. Another problem that I had once again with Christine Montalbetti, who's a wonderful writer, is she would write back to me and say, could you make this sound a little bit more like, and then she would cite an English poet, maybe a 19th century poet. This was the feeling that I was going for. How am I going to do that? You know, not being a poet myself and not being particularly familiar with whatever poet she mentioned, I'd have to look it up and see what is she going for? You know, she said that my translation was competent. It said what it said, and I wasn't making mistakes, but it flattened. I think that was the word that she used. It flattened her prose. And I found this very upsetting, and whew, it was hard. She finally, you know, we worked together. She would make suggestions. She was very honest. To have an author say that I'm flattening her prose is just,
That's intimidating.
it's very intimidating, but she's very gentle. I ended up meeting her. She was one of the ones that actually came to campus. And her English was good enough that she knew that there was a sound in English that would render the sound
Oh, when you
much
talk about
better.
the sounds, because the French language sounds so different, has such a different cadence from English.
The other publishers, they have their prize-winning stable of you see the same names coming back, is what I'm saying. When I look down the list of translators of books that win prizes, seems to always be the same ones. You know, they really are stellar at what they do, and they work fast. Well, here's an interesting anecdote. My husband and I went to Tokyo once because it was a Haruki Murakami festival that invited all of his translators from the world. So there was the English translator, the French translator, the Spanish translator. They were all there. And my husband gave the keynote for some reason. I don't know why they invited him to give the keynote, but it was astounding. I think it was sponsored by the government that they thought that was important enough that to gather all right down to the last, I mean, there must have been 30 translators there. He's been translated in everything. And they were gathered together and kind of honoring each other. I don't know what the common language was. I don't know if they're able to speak to one another. The common language was Japanese, clearly. You know, they were all, some cultures think about translation as their window onto the world. You know, Murakami would just be a Japanese writer if all of these people weren't willing to invest. And there was a circle of maybe three English translators, and I've been keeping track since then, and they just sort of rotate, it seems to me.
I am thinking about the idea of creative lives in a series of interviews I'm doing on Catch the Beat. And I certainly consider translation a creative endeavor. It's a craft, it's a skill, but it's also an art. What would you say about how you nurture that artistic aspect of what you do?
Once you're in a translation and they take months to do, you have a heightened awareness of language in all aspects. Ad copy, even. You think, oh, I wonder how that would work. It's a heightened awareness of the tricks of language. So you start asking yourself questions. Whenever I would read anything in translation, I think, I wonder what the original must have been. And if you're not really working on a translation, maybe you don't have that on the back burner going all the time. And I would find, even in musical lyrics or simple conversations, I would be asking myself constantly, what space would that occupy in French? Would it even make sense in French? Especially culturally, you know, is that even something that could possibly be a preoccupation or something that's so French? It's not the word. We're not talking about words in that case. It's just, you know, an attitude that's just plain unknown. You don't want a footnote. So I think those are the hardest things to render. And it's probably in some cases where the editor, and this often happens, they just plain leave it out. If it's something that's too American, it just won't make sense to these Greek readers or to these, you know, Hungarian readers. Just leave it out. No one will miss it. I remember the big scandal about Simone de Beauvoir. Was it Second Sex or, you know, one of her books? Whole swathes of of that book had been just skipped over. They said, this, we're not interested in this. Of course, that was nonfiction, but she's a very important and artistic writer, you know, even in her nonfiction
That
pieces.
verges on censorship.
Well, the new translation came out a few years ago. I remember reading a big long piece in the New York Review of Books about all the things that had been left out. and how criminal that was. And the new translation put them all right back in. And it was, you know, how could they possibly have thought that this wouldn't interest people, you know?
Now, you touched on something that I also know is dear to your heart, which is singing choral music.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, what place does that play in your creative life?
Well, right now, it's just everything. When I came back to the United States, I had been living 18 years in a country that doesn't have polyphonic music. If you listen to Arab music, all the strings, all the instruments, and the singer, they're all singing on the same note. It's very... Oh, I mean, you know how Andalusian and Arab inflected music is. But it's not polyphonic. They don't have Western, you know, J.S. Bach inspired polyphonic counterpoint. It just doesn't exist. And I didn't know how much I missed that until I came back and got back into, oh, I love it. I love it. I love it. So I kind of dove back into singing choral music, which I hadn't done since college, we're talking about the 1970s, by going in the shallow end and joining a local group called the Chorale, which was a non-audition community chorus, which happened to be very, very good, and they still exist. When I'm rehearsing at home and learning, I get goosebumps. Polyphonic music gives me goosebumps, and I don't know why. It just makes me quiver. We're doing right now in the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana, we're doing Bach Magnificat. Just saying the word, I'm getting goosebumps, you know, it's such a magnificent piece. Magnificent. I don't know. I don't understand what it does to my soul, but it's absolutely something that has been with me since childhood. It has to be. And I wasn't raised a Lutheran. I don't know all the Lutheran tunes, all the Bach, you know, stuff. I don't know why this happens. It's like in another life was I a singer in the Cambridge Boys Choir or something. I don't know, but it's what I love the most and what in my free time I spend the most time on at home. Because I'm not a intuitive sight reader, I really have to learn the piece. So I sit down like an idiot and sing it to myself in my office, you know, until I know it, like know it, know it. People say, isn't it draining? I said, it's absolutely the opposite. I come out of rehearsals so energized, so oxygenated, so inspired that I can't sleep. You know, these rehearsals go to 9:30 at night with the Oratory Society. And I just, look forward to them. So look forward to those rehearsals. And this is a very choral town.
It is.
I will say to your listeners, we have the chorale, we have CU Sings, we have the Oratory Society, we have Bach, the Baroque Artists, the Central Illinois Children's Choir. I mean, any day of the week, you can go hear choral music. It's just delightful. There's some very, very talented choral people.
Well, you know, that is one of the secret joys of WEFT to me. I do
yes.
Women Making Waves, 2 hours of women's music, and I come out of that 2 hours high as a kite.
Mm.
It's just being immersed in all this different music in the studio with your headphones, you know, you're really in
yeah.
it. And I think, oh, I wonder who's listening. I wonder if they enjoyed that song. Well, Jane, thank you so much.
The pleasure was mine.
It's
Co.
a delight to have you on Catch the Beat.
That wraps up our time for this week's Catch the Beat. I give a hearty thanks to Jane Kuntz, accomplished translator of books from French to English, and you may see her around town in various choirs, lending her voice to community spirit. You're listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, streaming on weft.org. All episodes of Catch the Beat are archived on the WEFT website at weft.org under Public Affairs. With thanks to Creative Commons for intro and outro music by Kevin MacLeod. See you next time.
Again, that was the Q&A from the talk and photo exposition.